It is a State Capitol Report on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A high-stakes conflict is brewing in Madison as Republicans consider impeaching a newly elected Supreme Court justice. And the court agrees to hear a legal challenge to the state's legislative maps that favor Republicans. We examine these latest developments and we catch up on other news in state politics, addressing transgender rights, childcare, and toxic chemicals in drinking water. Join the conversation at any time. Call in with your questions. You can share your comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Anya Van Wagtendonk is here, WPR's State Capitol reporter. Anya, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
So at this news conference Thursday, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss says impeaching newly elected Supreme Court Justice Janet Protasiewicz remains an option. Can you describe the position at present on impeachment and this evolving news?
Yeah. So for those who might be coming into this story newly, Voss and other Republican leaders have been calling on Protasiewicz for several months now to recuse from a lawsuit challenging the state's legislative maps. And so they've said that if she doesn't do so, impeachment would be on the table. Recently, Protasiewicz declined to recuse. The court will be taking up that challenge. However, at the same time, Speaker Voss had consulted with multiple former conservative justices about impeachment. And recently, on the same day that Protasiewicz said that she would not recuse, documents started coming out showing that they had advised against impeachment. They've said that, you know, that is the type of response that is for crimes or corruption in office. And Protasiewicz has not been accused of a crime. GOP complaints about her behavior traces back to comments that she made and donations she received on the campaign trail. So all of that brings us to last week. Voss told reporters that impeachment isn't off the table in spite of that guidance, but that he'll be watching for how she conducts herself in office, that he and fellow Republicans will be waiting to see how she rules and how the liberal majority now on the court rules on that maps case. He didn't say whether they would move to impeach if the new liberal majority rules against the current maps. He just said that they are looking for evidence of bias and will kind of go from there.
So Voss creates a panel to advise him on impeachment standards, and they include three former Supreme Court justices. Two justices, David Prosser and John Wilcox, caution against impeaching Protasiewicz. Does Speaker Voss agree with the former justices' views? Do we know all of the views?
We know two of the three, and this is because a group in D.C. has filed a separate lawsuit about the creation of this panel, saying that it violates open meeting rules, and in the process of that filed their own open records requests. And so that's kind of how we're getting some of this documentation. Of the justices that you mentioned, Prosser and Wilcox, they said both said that impeachment is such a severe consequence that it needs to be reserved for the most severe offenses, and also that, you know, pursuing impeachment in a way that could be perceived as political could backfire for Speaker Voss. Speaker Voss has said that he requested the advice sort of in the same way that he looks for expert information on other matters that he's legislating. So we don't know his exact take on their input, but he also said on Thursday that these legislative maps that are currently in place have been found to be legal by the Supreme Court before. They were upheld by the former conservative majority, so that a new court, even with a different ideological makeup, shouldn't find differently.
I wonder, is there any way of knowing how this back and forth could affect the high court? I mean, how could Speaker Voss's threatening to impeach Protasiewicz affect how the justices rule on upcoming cases?
I mean, I guess there's no real way of predicting that, but that has been one of the warnings around the conversation around impeachment, which is that this is a way of kind of encroaching on an independent judiciary, that if there is the threat of impeachment when a justice doesn't correspond with, or a justice's decision rather, doesn't correspond with what a legislative majority prefers, that could have a chilling effect on an independent judiciary. But again, those are kind of separate warnings. We don't have evidence yet that of what will come to be when it comes to Protasiewicz specifically, because, you know, she really has just started hearing cases in the last couple of weeks.
And before we move on here, just your crystal ball, could this redistricting case eventually wind up before the U.S. Supreme Court?
Yeah, so that's actually something that Voss has said as well, that we will see how this gets resolved, in part that there's the possibility that it could get elevated. I mean, I will say, the US Supreme Court takes vanishingly few cases every year. And so it's statistically not super likely that any one case from Wisconsin will end up there. But of course, it's not impossible. But that is, it's possible it might get sort of like remanded to a higher court. That doesn't necessarily mean that the US Supreme Court would take it up entirely. A MAPS case, in fact, went to the Supreme Court, the US Supreme Court, one time, but they did not officially take it up. So there are these kind of other channels, these ways that this might not get resolved anytime soon, this political battle. But it's sort of unclear what path it might go. There's a couple different options.
Anya Van Wagtendonk is WPR State Capitol reporter, getting us up to speed on the legislature, the back and forth news developments. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Nate in Milwaukee. Nate, hi.
Hi, thank you for having me. The current talk of impeachment reminded me of an Urban Milwaukee piece back in August done by Data Wonk, saying, titled, "Should Protasiewicz Recuse from Redistricting Cases?" And that particular piece finishes up by pointing out that Rebecca Bradley, there's a stronger argument she should recuse herself from this case, because unlike Jana Protasiewicz, she's actually made comments about the case itself in terms of whether or not she thinks it really has merit to it. And that means that if there's an argument about prejudging cases, that one of the conservative judges probably ought to leave the case alone rather than, or at least as much, if not more, than Janet Protasiewicz.
Nate, thank you. Anya, any insights there on the ripple effect of other justices who might be in such a situation of recusal?
Yeah, there is, precedent both at the state level and at the federal level for what Janet Protasiewicz did. So again, to remind listeners, she made certain comments about the maps on the trail, where she called them rigged and unfair. And she also took money from the Democratic Party. And so that is where, the crux of the GOP criticism comes from. Both of those things have been done by the other justices and are supported by both, the ethics standard of the court here in Wisconsin and by US law. Justices, people running for judicial positions, are allowed to express their personal opinions on important issues. That's a First Amendment protection, as long as they don't, again, prejudge a case, as the caller just said. And so, many reporters have pointed out, and people have done sort of the research to show that other sitting justices here in Wisconsin have taken money from political parties and other interested parties, and have also expressed, their First Amendment positions on certain issues. And so the recusal standards that we currently have don't seem to cover what Protasiewicz did on the campaign trail and who she took money from. And she herself, in a 64-page opinion, sort of agreed with that when she declined to recuse.
WPR's State Capitol reporter Anya Van Wagtendonk gets us up to speed on news from the state Supreme Court and the legislature. Call in with a question or comment, 800-642-1234. This is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. WPR's State Capitol reporter Anya Van Wagtendonk is here to talk about proposals moving through the state legislature and to answer your questions along the way. Call in with what you want to know, or you can share your perspective on bills at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Anya, yesterday Friday, the State Assembly approved a bill along party lines that would restrict minors from accessing some gender-affirming health care, including hormone therapy and surgery. What arguments are Republicans making for restricting this care?
Yeah, that was on Thursday,
Or Thursday,
actually.
yes.
And the idea is basically to prevent children and teenagers from making changes to their developing bodies until they're old enough to make informed consent. So Republicans say it's sort of like restrictions that we have on smoking, purchasing tobacco, or getting a tattoo for people under 18. Speaker Voss has also kind of likened the established science behind treatment for gender dysphoria as being imperfect. He compared it to, scientifically recommended treatments in the past that have not always stood the test of time, like how lobotomies were once used to treat mental illness. That's partly in response to the fact that basically every major medical organization at this point has recommendation guidelines for treating gender dysphoria in youth, which can sometimes include things like hormone therapy, puberty blockers, and then sometimes surgery. That's always following, significant evaluation done in consultation between providers and parents and the patient. So this is part of the argument that's taking place on the floor.
Meanwhile, Governor Evers is vowing to veto the legislation. How are Democratic lawmakers responding to the proposal?
Yeah, Democrats voted unanimously against the proposal, and Governor Evers has said that he will veto any legislation that he sees as targeting trans people and especially trans youth. Democrats argued that trans kids are at greater risk of poor mental health, particularly as a result of being kind of targeted or not affirmed in this way. So there are rates of, again, poor mental health, including suicide or suicidality, among trans youth, particularly in places that make it harder to access gender-affirming healthcare. So that's sort of the crux of their argument.
Meanwhile, in the state Senate, they heard testimony on their version of the medical transition bill. How much support do you see in the chamber in the Senate?
Yeah, so that just passed out of committee again on pure party lines, but it's not yet clear whether it'll be taken up by the Senate. It hasn't yet been scheduled.
What has testimony been like at public hearings on these bills?
Yeah, it's been pretty contentious and emotional. At the Assembly Committee hearing, not this past week, the week before, it was many, many hours long. Advocates came from all over to kind of protest against these bills. Again, that argument about the way that not offering gender affirming care to kids can affect their mental health, their sense of belonging, their sense of sort of well-being in their body, I think has really been the crux of it. And that's been on a very kind of personal level. And then the Republican response is that the bill is titled the Help Not Harm Bill. And so their idea is just that this is a way of making sure, again, that young people can fully consent to what is happening to their bodies. And so they make the argument that they too are looking out for trans and non-binary children by just wanting to sort of pump the brakes a little bit on medical treatment. And so it really is kind of an emotional debate on both sides.
We're going to move on to childcare here. On Wednesday, a Senate committee held a long hearing on Governor Evers' proposal to extend childcare subsidies. That was part of the hearing that were created with federal dollars made available from May 2020 until next January. What would these subsidies, what have been, what are these subsidies doing?
Yeah, so it's the Child Care Counts program, and it used federal COVID-19 relief dollars to basically stabilize the industry when everything was falling apart in 2020. It subsidized things like provider wages or things like sort of maintenance and operations costs. So in his budget proposal earlier this spring, Governor Evers asked for $340 million to continue that program. Republicans nixed it in their version of the budget. And so then, as you mentioned, Evers ordered this special session to reconsider that proposal. And so at the hearing last week, childcare providers and advocates have been saying that they need to continue that funding. They've actually been at the Capitol kind of all year, advocating to continue this program, saying that it's an industry in crisis in general. The childcare crisis preceded, the pandemic, but that this kept things afloat and that childcare centers are going to close without significant sort of input of public dollars.
What's been the testimony around why these centers can't raise rates to pay their employees more?
Yeah, essentially that childcare is already quite expensive, quite inaccessible for most working people. Wisconsin is more than half of Wisconsin is what's considered a childcare desert. So that's where there are three or more children for every open licensed childcare slot. So there's just simply not enough space in childcare centers for every Wisconsin child who might need it. And so part of the argument is that like once you start raising tuition rates for families, and families can't pay for childcare anymore, that women will drop out of the workforce. They will be forced to stay home with their kids. And so that it will have ripple effects, not just for these centers that might not be able to stay open if they have to kind of raise costs in other ways, but that it'll also affect the parents and primarily the mothers of children who need to go to childcare or who are childcare age, I should say.
We're talking with Anya Van Wagtendonk, WPR's State Capitol reporter, as we get updates on bills gaining traction in the legislature. You can join in with your questions, bills you're tracking, and your comments at 800-642-1234. Turning to forever chemicals, PFAS, the committee approval clears the way for the full Senate to vote on the legislation that would create a framework for awarding these grants to deal with PFAS contamination in water. It would then move on to the assembly. Democrats on the committee worry that the plan would let polluters off the hook. How would this proposal work?
Yeah, so it would provide grants to municipalities and landfills for addressing PFAS contamination. And then the other part of it is that it sort of limits DNR power in certain ways, what's called an innocent landowners clause. So DNR would not be able to order certain innocent landowners, so landowners who did not cause this pollution, to test for or clean up the chemicals. Republicans say that without that, people or business owners or farmers might not want to test for PFAS because if it's found on their property and they're on the hook for cleaning it up, that can be sort of life-ruiningly expensive. And so they are saying that kind of loosening some of those restrictions while also having state money available for cleanup and testing, will kind of solve that predicament that some landowners can find themselves in.
So, returning to this limits placed on the DNR through the amendments to the bill, could this bill limit the actions the DNR could take in order to do, to hold corporate company, polluter, holding them accountable for PFAS contamination?
Yeah, that's exactly what critics of this bill say, is that, the image in your head might be an individual landowner, an individual farmer, but that really, this is letting sort of major corporations, industry, manufacturers off the hook. They say that, the definition of innocent landowners can expand to include these sort of major polluters, and that it allows them to sort of get out of the responsibility for cleanup. So that's really been the sort of Democratic criticism and criticism from major environmental groups across the state.
What does Governor Evers think of the changes to the bill?
Essentially that it is not a kind of serious proposal for dealing with PFAS pollution.
So, turning to the Brewers, the assembly is expected to vote tomorrow on a deal to fund renovations at the Milwaukee Brewers Stadium. How much would the state tax dollars contribute to these renovations?
Yeah, this is overall a $546 million plan. So that's going to be paid over 30 years. And the idea is it'll guarantee that the Brewers stay in Milwaukee until 2050. The state would chip in $411 million of that. So then Milwaukee City and County would get the rest. And then the Brewers separately would contribute about $100 million. As you mentioned, the assembly is set to vote on it tomorrow. There's been a lot of back and forth on this for quite a while. And it now has Democratic sign off and local sign off from Milwaukee County and city leaders after some last minute changes that lowered the amount of the Milwaukee side of the contributions. So we will see how that passes. But a number of Democratic lawmakers have said that they are now on board. And so it's looking good
Is the
for this bill.
push for this legislation, is the impetus because we could lose the Brewers if these renovations don't happen?
Yeah, that's been sort of the argument. Their lease with the stadium expires in 2030. And so the concern has been that they would leave. There's been sort of mixed signals, I think, from the team, but the idea is that this will ensure that they are there until 2050, and it'll also, contribute to maintenance and repairs and like a winterization effort for the stadium that could allow it to be, a continual sort of economic engine for the area. That's the argument in favor of this investment.
Anya, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Anya Van Wagtendonk is WPR's State Capitol reporter. And stay with us as we hear from the new reentry director for the Wisconsin Department of Corrections and the work in DOC on reentry. This is a State Capitol report. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is a State Capitol report on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We hear now from the top official at the State Department of Corrections overseeing efforts to help incarcerated people transition back into communities. Thousands of discharges happen at state prisons every year, and a new package of proposals in the legislature this year aims to help people find jobs and housing. Be part of our conversation about moving from life behind bars to life in a community. Call in with your questions, your experiences, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ray Woodruff is reentry director at the State Department of Corrections. Ray, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. You were named reentry director this spring for the Department of Corrections, and you've worked for the department since 2009, largely overseeing education and employment programs. What are the biggest challenges to finding jobs for newly released prisoners?
Yeah, that's correct. I have been with the Wisconsin Department of Corrections since 2009, and prior to that, I was with the Ohio Department of Corrections. So obviously, individuals who are exiting incarceration face a host of barriers when reentering the workforce. A criminal record in and of itself tends to be a significant barrier. A lot of folks get weeded out through the process of applying for jobs based on that criminal record. Skill deficits tend to be a significant barrier that we spend a lot of time in the Department of Corrections working on building up education, working towards employability, developing those employability skills, some of those soft skills that can transition from job to job. Transportation tends to be a significant issue for our population. If they are able to get a job, but they don't have reliable transportation or they don't have a license, these things all can become barriers that ultimately prevent people from engaging meaningfully in the workforce.
It is, you mentioned a bunch of things here. It's not just like reconnecting with the world, reconnecting with family and friends, but it's like getting basic needs like a place to live, a job, transportation. So many facets have to be addressed through the transition, through that reentry.
Well, absolutely. It's a significant point in time, obviously, for an individual who is releasing from incarceration. If you can imagine potentially being incarcerated for really any amount of time, but perhaps several years, the challenges that would await you as you come back to the community from a very structured, secure setting to the community where maybe things have changed significantly since you became incarcerated and you're trying to find certainly a job, but also those basic things that we all need, shelter, potentially transportation, food, all these things that sometimes I think we take for granted. People who are coming back from incarceration certainly have to deal with a lot of different barriers as they try to reenter society, try to be pro-social individuals and meaningfully reconnect with the world outside of incarceration.
So four bills in the legislature this year aim to improve the employment and housing prospects of formerly incarcerated people. And one proposal would expand eligibility to earn early release. How does the earned release program work now?
So earned release right now is fairly limited in scope to individuals who have significant substance use disorder issues that need to be addressed. And so sentencing court can identify that folks who have this very specific need, if they complete certain types of programs, they may be eligible to petition the court to earn their release early from incarceration. But that's really the only opportunity through earned release at this time.
What changes would this legislation bring? Who would additionally become eligible for earned early release?
Well, again, you know, we'll have to wait and see ultimately how the final legislation is written. But ultimately, this would allow people who have needs associated with education and employment, if the sentencing court identifies it, that they could, you know, people who complete certain types of education or employment-related programming could potentially be able to, again, petition the court early for that earned release. And, you know, that could be applicable to a significant number of people. And, you know, I certainly don't know all of the details of every offense category that would be appropriate for earned release, but typically those don't include those violent offenses. So people who have been convicted of certain types of violent crimes typically would not be able for the earned release in this case as well. But it would open up the opportunity for people who are engaging meaningfully in those educational and employment related programs and successfully complete to potentially go back to the sentencing court and earn that early release.
How long are waiting lists for people who want to earn early release?
The waiting lists, it varies obviously by location. People who have the ability based on their sentencing court's judgment are regularly able to get into the current earned release programming. There's not a significant wait list for those who are eligible under the current under current law.
Ray Woodruff is with us, reentry director at the Wisconsin Department of Corrections, as we talk about employment and education programs for incarcerated people and the transition back into communities. You can join in with your questions, your perspectives. They're welcome at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Ray, one bill in the legislature would establish a telephone hotline for employers who are looking to hire formerly incarcerated people. Could this idea address workforce shortages in Wisconsin?
Well, sure. I think anything that can reduce any of those barriers that we had discussed earlier is a good thing. And I think for our part, for the Department of Corrections, we've worked over the last decade plus to really integrate our services with the Department of Workforce Development, the workforce development boards throughout the state, and with employers, specifically employers, to try to address some of those workforce shortages that do exist. We've developed and implemented many various programs to try to meet the needs of employers. You know, we understand that the reality of the job market out there. And we also understand that we have a population of individuals who are very skilled, who go through specific programs and who are able to take some of those opportunities out in the community to address those workforce shortages. So should this bill pass, I certainly think we work very closely with our partner agencies to address the needs that exist in the community. And so I think should this bill pass, we will be well positioned to provide resources to employers out there who are in need of workers.
Corrections also operates reentry centers at 11 state facilities, and one bill would have the department contract with an outside agency to establish a community reentry center. How would a community reentry center be different from the existing centers?
Yeah, sure. So I think there's a slight distinction. So the 11 institution-based job labs that we have in our Department of Corrections is a partnership with the Department of Workforce Development. So these are in institution labs, essentially, where individuals can utilize essentially job center resources that are existing in the community, but haven't traditionally existed in corrections. And so we have these locations where individuals can develop resumes, they can search for real-time jobs that exist out in the community, they can apply for jobs, they can interview for jobs, and they can accept jobs, all prior to release. And this has been a significant collaboration of ours with the Department of Workforce Development and the Workforce Development Boards over the, since 2018 to establish these. And so we have staff from these various agencies coming in and providing services in these spaces to help people that are reentering the community. The legislation that's currently proposed with regard to the reentry, the community-based reentry center, I kind of think of it as almost like a one-stop shop location in the community, where individuals who maybe are under our supervision, who are coming out of incarceration, would potentially be able to go to this location and receive, let's just say they could meet with a housing representative, for instance, or somebody from another state agency, maybe the Department of Transportation, to work on, if they don't already have it, work on obtaining their license. So I think there would be a lot. There's a lot of logistical things that we still need to coordinate and figure out should this bill pass. But I think we're certainly open to working with our partners to really define what would really be valuable in a space like this and what would make the most sense for our population.
Sounds like it would really take a wraparound services approach to reentry. I'm wondering, you know, do nonprofits and churches have a role in reentry transitions?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think, you know, from my perspective, I certainly believe that the Department of Corrections plays a critical role in working to provide space for our clients to be successful during their incarceration and post-incarceration. And it's a significant role, but I think it's only one piece of the puzzle. And my goal is that we can continue to coordinate and collaborate with various stakeholders that are operating in the space, whether it's nonprofits, it's other state agencies, it's religious groups, because again, we're just one piece of the puzzle. And so we make a concerted effort wherever we can to collaborate and work with others, whether that's through directly contracted programming or just coordinating our services in a more meaningful way to better provide, as you mentioned, sort of those wraparound, the concept of a wraparound services for clients who, again, we talked earlier, experience many different barriers as they reenter the community.
Ray Woodruff is Reentry Director at the State Department of Corrections, overseeing the work of transitioning incarcerated people from state prisons back into communities. Call in with your questions, your comments about efforts to improve these transitions, 800-642-1234. This is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The supporters of several bills moving through the legislature this year say the proposals would help incarcerated people find jobs and housing after release. And one bill would expand eligibility for early release programs. Join in with your question, your views on helping transition people back into communities. 800-642-1234, the number to call with your question. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Ray Woodruff, who is the State Department of Corrections Reentry Director. Ray, we had a caller who works for a manufacturing company in Dane County, and this company employs people from a minimum security prison. And they said they're excellent employees. They get terrific support. And the company has been doing this for 4 years. And formerly incarcerated people make up about 5% of the workforce at this company. What do you make of that type of arrangement?
Well, that's great to hear. You know, I think we often hear that, quite frankly, from companies that we do work with. You know, we have several minimum community custody centers that are located throughout the state where individuals who are approaching their release are eligible for work release opportunities. So they may be currently still incarcerated. They come back to the institution in the evenings or whatever their shift is, but they are able to be out in the community working alongside members of the public. And we often discover that when working with our employer partners, that the individuals that we send to those employers are often motivated to do well. They have skills. They provide a service to those companies. And we do take a lot of effort into finding the right individuals to go out into the community. So we do a lot of analysis and evaluation of our population as they approach their release date to determine who's most appropriate for those work release opportunities. So from my perspective, work release is a tremendous opportunity for not only our population, but also those employers that are out in the community.
I want to turn to higher ed. This summer, the Department of Education lifted restrictions that had prevented incarcerated students from obtaining federal Pell Grants. How often are incarcerated people in Wisconsin able to access this money to pay for college courses?
Yeah, so when Second Chance Pell first became an option back in around 2015, one of the colleges in the state, Milwaukee Area Technical College, was an institution that was identified as being able to offer Pell Grants for incarcerated individuals. And during the time of that first phase, we had almost 500 different students throughout the state were able to access Pell Grant funding through this process and take programming at Milwaukee Area Technical College. The second phase began, I want to say it was a couple of years, almost 2 years ago, two other additional colleges in the state, Madison College and Moraine Park Technical College, also were able to offer Pell Grant funded programming to incarcerated students. And, you know, again, many students who are incarcerated are engaged and want to take these opportunities to better their lives and to enhance their education so that they can ultimately reintegrate meaningfully into the community. And so there are many individuals who are incarcerated who, should this come to pass, you know, we will work with all of these institutions who are able to offer education to our population to try to meet the demand, because there is always demand amongst our population.
Do you think that you will see a growing number of technical colleges establishing these pathways?
I do. Yeah, absolutely. I think there are a lot of colleges that are interested. There are a lot of logistical things that we need to coordinate and figure out about how students access programs while they may be at one institution. How do they access a program on the other side of the state? There are things that we need to do to ensure safety and security, obviously, of our facilities. But we're invested in it. We're committed to these partnerships, and we absolutely look forward to working with our educational partners to make this a reality.
Ray Woodruff is Reentry Director at the Wisconsin Department of Corrections. As we look at employment and education programs for incarcerated people and the transition back into the community, you can join in with your questions and your insights. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ray, the Wisconsin Policy Forum says our state is the only state where people are unable to remove charges from their records even after serving sentences. And residents age 25 and older at the time of their crime are ineligible for expungement. How much does a criminal record affect securing work or housing after incarceration?
Yep. It's a significant barrier, as we discussed. We know that there are background check practices that occur all the time for, you know, initial employment. I think the testimony earlier that you had from a certain employer, certainly there, certain employers obviously are willing to overlook certain criminal records, but it continues to be a barrier for our population, whether it's at the initial point of application or whether it's through the interviewing process. I think having that criminal record continues to be a barrier for folks, even after maybe they have served their period of incarceration, they have taken all of the programming that's available to them, they've enhanced their education, they've taken employment-related programming, they're working positively in their community to address some of the issues that they faced before they became incarcerated. That criminal record certainly still hangs over their head. And it is a barrier, and I think it will continue to be absent the ability to have that record expunged.
In our moments together here, let's turn to housing. What programs currently exist to find people housing and help them avoid becoming homeless after incarceration?
Yeah, so our Division of Community Corrections makes a concerted effort to work with our clients to ensure that they have housing post-release, certainly if they're on supervision following their release from incarceration. We have various types of housing that we actually contract for as an agency, whether that be temporary housing or short-term secured settings at times. So our agency makes certainly a concerted effort to ensure that folks have that opportunity to have some type of housing after their release. That said, there are always individuals who may choose not to avail themselves of those opportunities, but it is a continual struggle, to be quite honest, for our agency, because we know there is a lot of need amongst our population, and we absolutely want to meet that need, but it's difficult. It is absolutely difficult, and so obviously one of the pieces of legislation seeks to enhance that concept of rental readiness for our population. That I'm certain we would enjoy working with our partners to make that a reality.
Well, I would imagine, too, with the rise of rents, that is creating more stresses to this piece of post-release and creating a life. Ray, thank you so much for joining us and for sharing your work.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Ray Woodruff is Reentry Director at the State Department of Corrections. He was appointed to the position this spring after working in several roles at the agency since 2009. This is a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.